As always, it's a great schluss for us to have Rav Schechter here with us. And as I mentioned in the past, Rav Schechter is sought after in many places. And the fact that the Shiva chooses our community is something which is a tremendous honor for us. Tonight, Rav Schechter's shiur is being sponsored by Jack and Debbie Becker and by Stan and Sheba Middleman. And the topic is one that is very interesting. It's really touching on a number of different subjects. Without further ado, introduce Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita.
In a certain sense, the whole Jewish people is one big family. We look to Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov as Elokeinu v'Kei Aviseinu, as the fathers of the Jewish people. We are insistent on giving respect to the parents, in order that we should give respect to our ancestors, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, to altogether the whole Jewish people. The mitzvah of Kibbud Aviyim, the two mitzvahs in the Chumash, one is Kibbud Aviyim, to give service to one's parents. My father needs a ride to the airport, and my father needs someone to carry his luggage, and my father needs someone to cook him a cup of tea or something like that. So then this is the obligation of Kibbud Aviyim. Or to give pleasure to my parents, to bring the grandchildren once in a while, within reason, to call on telephone, to say hello, to send letters, to send photographs of the grandchildren, so on, depending how close the children live to the parents. So the basic obligation is to give service to the parents and to be mahana the parents. By single children, they're mahana the parents. Let's say the parents are busy running around all week long, going to work, and the children running to school, so they never eat together. At least on Shabbos and Yom Tov, they all eat together. So if the children are going to go away every Shabbos to visit their friends, or every Shabbos there's a Shabbaton somewhere else, so the parents will feel bad about this. They don't have the pleasure of spending time with their own children, so the children have an obligation to give the parents pleasure. That's the mitzvah of Kibbud Aviyim. And then there's the mitzvah of Mora. Mora means to give respect to the parents, not to call the parents by their first name, and so on and so forth, to be respectful to parents. The Talmud has an expression, the Talmud burns out from the Psukim and the Chumash, that the obligation of Kibbud applies, Mechabdo Mechayim, Mechabdo Lachamosa. The mitzvah is to be Mechabdo the parents even after they die. So that's a big problem. How can you service the parents after they die? The Talmud should have really said that the mitzvah Mora, to show respect to the parents, applies even after they die. But how can you give service to the parents after they die? So in Shulchan Aruch, they have a minhag based on a passage in the Zohar. This doesn't appear anywhere in the Talmud. This is based on the Zohar. That in case the parent deserves to go to Gehenna because of some others that they did, so if the children, children or grandchildren, descendants, will recite Kaddish, this will somehow help the parents, save them from suffering in Gehenna. So in a certain sense, this is service to the parents. You save the parents from suffering in Gehenna. Because the Talmud makes a statement that the maximum anyone ever suffered, the biggest rush in the world, the maximum they ever suffer in Gehenna is 12 months. So that's why the custom is that the children don't want to imply as if the parents were such rishonim that they may have to be burning in Gehenna for 12 months. So that's why the custom is that when children recite Kaddish, they only recite Kaddish for 11 months. Once the 11th month is up, so they don't recite Kaddish. The Avelus, the mourning period, is supposed to extend for the whole first year. For 12 months. But the reciting of the Kaddish is only 11 months, but they shouldn't imply as if the parents really need the Kaddish for the whole 12 months. Reciting of Kaddish only makes sense for children, to recite Kaddish when a parent dies. When someone else says Kaddish, someone dies and he only has daughters. And the daughters feel uncomfortable going to shul every day saying Kaddish, so they want to have one of the grandchildren say Kaddish. So that's fine. The children and grandchildren are an extension of the parents of the grandparents. So the Talmud has an expression, bro, the son, mizaka abba, the mitzvahs, tzedakah that the children give, or the grandchildren give, or whatever mitzvahs they do, is considered as a schus for their parents or for their grandparents, because the children are an extension of their parents. Bro, mizaka abba, but abba lo mizaka bro. Let's say, chalila v'chalila, a child dies. So the father's going to give tzedakah as a schus for his child. The father is not an extension of the child. The child is an extension of the father. The father's going to recite Kaddish. How is that going to help for the child? when the child recites Kaddish for the father, that's the children are extensions of the parents, but not the reverse. So that's why many times, if let's say someone dies, he leaves only daughters, and the daughters don't feel comfortable going to shul saying Kaddish every day. So it's recommended that the grandchildren should recite Kaddish. Sometimes the parents are alive of the grandchild, and they get the heebie-jeebies why the son is saying Kaddish. Why should they have the heebie-jeebies? Well, what's the problem? It's all psychological. So the grandchild should ask permission from his parents. There's no reason why modern people shouldn't have the EBGs. Maybe Europeans have these kind of Americans. Why should they be worried because their son is saying Kaddish? What's going to happen? So if they'll give him permission, he should say Kaddish for the grandfather. Strictly speaking, the Kaddish is only for children. If people make a mistake, they think whenever one observes Avelis, so the one who's observing Avelis has to recite Kaddish. So the child observes Avelis for a whole year. So they say that's why he recites Kaddish for 11 months, and a brother observes Avelis for 30 days, for Shloshim, so the brother recites Kaddish for 30 days. There is no such thing. The Kaddish is only recited by the children, not by the siblings.
What if someone, for example, doesn't have children, and has a sibling?
So it says in Shulchan Aruch, if one doesn't have any descendants who can say Kaddish, you ask someone else to say Kaddish, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not going to make it any better or worse if it's going to be a sibling. It's just as good if a stranger is going to say it. Best is that a descendant, either a child or a grandchild, great-grandchild, should recite the Kaddish. The Talmud has also a strange... Talmud doesn't have this about reciting Kaddish. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch in the Zohar. The Talmud gives a strange form of kavod after the parent dies, that whenever the child speaks of the father within the first 12 months, child speaks of the father and mother, he should say, Hareni kaparas mishkovo. Very strange concept. I accept upon myself whatever suffering my parent should deserve because of whatever sins that they may have done. So I accept it upon myself that they should punish me instead of the parents. That's called mechabda lachamos. I'm easing their suffering in Gehenna. I tell the Bezon Shalmaila, I'm telling the Rabban Shalom, instead of causing my parents to suffer, they should punish me. So why should that help? I don't know. If I'm a tzaddik and my parents are the ones who did the Avera, so they deserve to burn again. Why is it, how am I a balabas to volunteer? But that's what the Talmud says, a very strange concept, that within the first year, when one speaks of his parents, within the first year after they die, so he should volunteer, Hareni kaparas mishkava, I volunteer to accept upon myself whatever suffering the parents should deserve, it should come to me, and I should lighten the burden of my parents. The strange thing, that's called mechavda lachamosa. Covered in the sense of physical service, I spare them from suffering. Strictly speaking, the Talmud says that there is no mitzvah of kibbur aviyim towards grandparents, even if the child was an orphan and he was raised by the grandparents. The child certainly should demonstrate gratitude towards the grandparents, but the Talmud says that, strictly speaking, there's no obligation of kibbur av. The same is true regarding one who adopts a child. Strictly speaking, he raised the child from infancy on, so the children have to be makir tova, they have to show appreciation. But strictly speaking, it's not his father, so it's not really the mitzvah of kibbur aviyim. Strictly speaking, let's say if an adoptive parent dies, so there is no obligation to observe avelus, because it's not my blood relative, it's not my parent. But in Shulchan Aruch, they explain, based on passages in the Gemara, that there is a concept of someone volunteering avelus if a dear friend dies, even if I'm not related to this person. If I like the person very much, so it makes sense that I should volunteer to sit shiva to observe shloshim. It probably does not make sense to observe, they don't discuss this in Shulchan Aruch, probably does not make sense to observe avelus yud beis chodesh, because there's a difference. We have a concept of Eina Mitzuva V'yosa. Let's say women are, strictly speaking, not obligated to shake a lulav. Women are, strictly speaking, not obligated to sit in sukkah to listen to the Tkiyah Shofar. That's what we call a mitzvah Saseh Shahazman Groma, a mitzvah that has to do with a specific day. The mitzvah of Shofar is only on Rosh Hashanah. The mitzvah of lulav is only on Sukkot, and so on. But nonetheless, the Talmud tells us that if a woman wants to volunteer, so that's wonderful. She will get reward as an Eina Mitzuva V'yosa. A woman volunteers to fulfill a mitzvah she's not obligated to observe, so she will get reward. But it doesn't make sense to volunteer to observe a Lois Essay There is no such thing. We have mitzvahs asay, and we have mitzvahs loisay asay. So when it comes to an aveira, if there's no aveira, if there's no isis, it doesn't make sense, I'm going to volunteer. If it's mutter, it's mutter. If there's something that's a mitzvah that I'm not obligated to do, but if other people are obligated, and when they shake a lulav, they're performing a mitzvah. So if a woman will shake a lulav, she's also performing a mitzvah, so she gets reward. But when it comes to a lois essay, if strictly speaking there's no isis, so there's no isis, so it does make sense to volunteer. So there's a fundamental difference between shiva and shloshim on the one hand, as opposed to avelis yid beis chodesh. In shiva and in shloshim, one is fulfilling a mitzvah saseh, midirabbanan. The whole law of avelis, observing avelis, is midirabbanan. You have to show respect for living people. Kavod avias, more, we have to show more respect for the living people than for the dead people. Usually people do the reverse. You show respect for the dead people, they didn't respect them so much while they were alive. So the Talmud says, the Pasuk says, we have to show respect for the dead. Kavachayim, we have to show respect for the living people. It's more of an obligation. So the mitzvah to show respect for the dead people, to observe Shiva, to observe Shloshim, that's a mitzvah, midirabbanan. That's a mitzvah, saseh. So even if it's not a blood relative of mine, the Talmud seems to imply if it's a close friend and I want to demonstrate respect for him, so it would make sense to volunteer the Shiva or to volunteer the Shloshim. But it doesn't make sense to volunteer Yud Beis Chodesh Avelis after the Shloshim, because there is no Kumi Aseh there. There is, during the year after the Shloshim is up, there are only Isurim. There are no mitzvahs. You're not allowed to go to parties, and you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to take your haircut until you absolutely look awful, and so on. So they're just Isurim there. So probably, Shulchanah, they don't discuss it, but it probably does not make sense to volunteer, let's say, for an adoptive parent, and it's not a blood relative. So the Rabbanim in recent years recommend that the adoptive parent took care of the child. So you should volunteer Shiva, you should volunteer Shlosh. It doesn't make sense to volunteer the Yud Beis Chodesh. Then furthermore, they point out whenever one is volunteering Avelis of Shiva and Shloshim, so one should not volunteer to observe the full Shiva all day long. The person is going to sit Shiva all day long. That doesn't make sense. You should observe Shiva a couple of hours a day, and then you should go home to lead a normal life. Or let's say the person is one who would normally learn a Daf Yomi. And when one is in Avelis, you're not supposed to study Gemara. A person is one who would normally learn Parshas HaShavua. He would learn whatever he would learn. He would do a mitzvah. So now he wants to volunteer observance of Avelis, and one is in Avelis, and not allowed to learn. So that doesn't make sense. He should volunteer Avelis that he's not obligated to observe in order not to learn. Or let's say his wife just came home from the mikveh tonight, and he's supposed to be with his wife, so he's not a volunteer Avelis not to be with his wife. He's meshuvah to be with his wife. What kind of business is that? You're not supposed to volunteer Avelis if it's going to be in conflict with other obligations that you have. If it's not in conflict, so then hechetesi, you volunteer Avelis. When one is, we have a lot of cases like this, when one is adopted and raised by an adoptive, let's say, father, and then they get married. So the question is, how do you write Niksuba? The child has no connection at all with their real father, with their biological father, whatever. The father left the mother, got divorced when the child was born, before the child was born. So how do you write Niksuba? So many have the practice, they write Ploni, the son of Ploni, Hamamtso, who adopted him. So then there's absolutely no problem whatsoever. Strictly speaking, you don't even have to write the word Hamamtso. The person can write Ploni ben Ploni. He can get an aliyah called up to the Torah, Ploni ben Ploni. In Chumash, when you have the list, I think it may be in this week's Sedra, when you have the list of all of the Jews who went down to Egypt in the beginning, so one of the names is Serach bas Osher, Serach the daughter of Osher. So the Targum Onkelos writes, and that pasuk, Serach was the daughter of the wife of Osher. She was the stepdaughter of Osher. It wasn't really his daughter, and the Chumash refers to her as Serach bas Osher. So the Chasam Sofer and Etshuva points this out. Chasam Sofer was asked a shaila. There was a man who for years was getting aliyahs, Pliny ben Pliny. When he called him up to the Torah, so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. And he used to sign Ksubas, he used to sign Gittin by that name, Pliny ben Pliny. Everybody thought that was his father. He always went under that name. One fine day, he's in his 30s, he marries his father's sister. You're not allowed to marry an aunt. It's an Issachar. He said, what are you, crazy? You married your aunt? He says, no, that man was never my father. He adopted me. He raised me. I was an orphan. So the Chasam Sofer says, we can believe him. And he can continue to get aliyahs with the name Pliny ben Pliny. He can continue to sign on the Gittin, sign on the Ksuvas Pliny ben Pliny. Because that's what it says in the Chumash, Serach Bas Asher. And the Targum Onkelos says, it wasn't really, Serach was not really the daughter of Asher, she was the stepdaughter of Asher. She was the daughter of Bas Itas Asher. So a lot of times you have it like that. A boy was adopted, or he was raised, even if he wasn't officially adopted with the government agencies. He was just raised by his stepfather. He has no connection at all with the father. So when you write the Ksuba, you can write to Pliny ben Pliny. He doesn't become a Kohen because he's adopted, even if he's officially adopted by the other person, doesn't become a Levi. Or if a Jew adopts a non-Jewish child, the non-Jewish child doesn't become automatically Jewish. You have to undergo an act of conversion. But you can still, in Hebrew, you can use the expression Ploni, Ben Ploni, even though it's not a biological child, because the person is being raised by that person. We have couples who are married, who are unable to have children without the assistance of a doctor. So they sometimes need artificial insemination from the husband to the wife. So this is really a big question, whether the children are misyaches, the children are children of the mother, that's for sure. The mother carried the baby for 9 months and she gave birth to the baby. The question is, the father, the husband is clearly the genetic father of the child. But al pidin, is he considered the father? Is the child considered a kohen or a levi because of the fact that the husband is a kohen or a levi? Or should we say no, the father is not related to the biological father, is al pidin not related to the child? So this is a discussion, believe it or not, in chapter 1 in Ibn Ezra. In the very first siman, the very first chapter of Ibn Ezra, they discuss, the early achrayim discuss, and they quote from the Rishon, from the Baal HaTosfos, they talk about artificial insemination, whether the donor of the semen is Yotze de Mitzvah Pir B'Rivya, whether the children are Mesiach and Sachar or not. So this was years ago, this was a big dispute, whether if you have a situation with artificial insemination, are the children Mesiach is after the father or not. I remember I was once talking about this topic at on the week of Parsha Shmos. There's an organization in Eretz Yisrael, there's an institute that's called the Machon Pua. In Parsha Shmos it says about Shifra Pua, that they took care of the baby. So Machon Pua, Pua is a Rosh Yeshivas, it's an institute for people who have fertility problems. So they help the people out, and if you're a Sfardi, so you want to follow Ramot Chalio, you want to follow this rabbi, the other rabbi, Ashkenazim, so they worked out all the psalkim, all the different opinions of all the different rabbanim, whichever rabbi you subscribe to, they'll tell you, they'll advise you in accordance with your rabbi's psak. So it's a group of rabbanim, and they have doctors there, and they have nurses, and they work on fertility issues. So I remember once, they always have their annual conference, all-day-long conference, on one of the days of Parshas Shmos. I remember twice, I happened to be in Eretz Yisrael, so they insisted I should participate. So one occasion I was talking about this. They have one speaker after the other, all day long. People sit and listen for hours to discussions. So I remember I was talking about this topic. Let's say you have a husband and a wife who can't have children without the assistance of a doctor, but it's clear that the husband is the father of the child, genetic father of the child. Is he considered al pidin the father? So I was saying that it was a big dispute years ago. So one of the listeners was very upset. He came over to me afterwards. He's a kohen, and he needed assistance of a doctor. So he said, what do you mean it's a question? Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach told me my children can duchen. So I said, okay. If he's paskin for you, they can duchen. Means that they are your children, they're Mesiachas. But not all the rabbanim agree. Many are of the opinion. It's a discussion in Shulchan Aruch in the first chapter. Many are of the opinion that the only time the father is related to the children is if they have the children in a normal fashion. If the woman has children from someone other than her own husband, if a woman has a married woman has an affair with someone else, even with the permission of the husband, the children will be mamzer. What if you have over here, the woman had artificial insemination from someone else? If the donor is a non-Jew, then there's no law of mamzerus. Let's say a married woman has an affair with a non-Jew. It's prohibited, but if she has an affair with a non-Jew, she has a child. So the Talmud says that the child will not be a mamzer. So what if, if you have artificial insemination from a non-Jew into a Jewish woman who's married, so of course the child won't be a mamzer. The question is, what if you have artificial insemination from someone other than the husband who is Jewish? Will that render the child as a mamzer? So this was discussed, believe it or not, 100 years ago. when they were first starting artificial insemination in Europe 100 years ago. So Yosef Engel, who died around 100 years ago, thinks that the child will be a mamzer, even though they probably didn't violate any aver of leisinuf. There was no violation of an aver, and still, this child has a father and a mother who couldn't have been married to each other. And the Ibn Ezra says that is the definition of mamzer me'em zar, from a strange mother. The father and the mother were strange to each other. They couldn't have had tefisas kiddushin because the woman was married to someone else. And at the time that she conceived with this child, she couldn't have been married to this individual. If you have two single people, a single boy makes a single girl pregnant, they could have theoretically, they could have gotten married. So just because they didn't get married doesn't make the child a mamzer. But if the woman is an Eishes Ish and she couldn't have had tefisas kiddushin with this other Jewish man, so then the child is a mamzer. Rabbi Yosef Engel is of the opinion that the children will be mamzer even though they didn't violate leisinuf, because it's me'em zara. Moshe Feinstein's opinion has been accepted. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say in public years ago, he doesn't know what the din is. And that people would call him up and harass him. He said, I don't know what the din is. But you're the chief rabbi, Einstein. He said, I don't know what the din is. He doesn't know what the din is. But then Rabbi Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva that the child is not a mamzer. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, that's it. We'll rely on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He said the child is not a mamzer. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was a first cousin of Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother. And he was 10 years older than Rabbi Soloveitchik. So that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik was prepared to rely on many of the psukim of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, even though he didn't fully understand why it should be so. He said, we're going to rely on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. The child is not a mamzer. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has an added kiddush in his long essay about this situation. When a woman had artificial insemination from another Jewish man, not from a non-Jew, from a Jewish man. So he says, not only is the child not a mamzer, if it's a daughter, if it's a girl that's born, she's permitted to marry a kohen. Normally, the Talmud says if a Jewish woman lives with a non-Jewish man and they have a daughter, so the daughter may not marry a kohen. The daughter is not permitted to marry a kohen. So Moshe Feinstein is of the opinion that's only if the woman was actually living, they were living together. A Jewish woman was living together with a non-Jewish man, and they have a daughter, the daughter is not allowed to marry a kohen. But if they weren't living together, just the woman was artificially inseminated, so Moshe thinks that she is permitted to marry a kohen. Not everybody agrees to that. The Ravid, in his commentary on the Rif, on Yevamos, explains what's the nature of this din. What kind of a strange halacha is that? If the father's not Jewish and the mother's Jewish, the child is Jewish. So why should the din be that if it's a daughter, she's not permitted to marry a kohen? So the Ravid writes a very brief explanation. He says a kohen has to marry a girl with a yichus. A kohen is not permitted to marry a girl who converted, because she doesn't have any parents. Once a non-Jewish person converts, he or she is no longer related to their previous relatives. So if a girl converted, so she has no parents at all. So even if her girl's mother, if you have a Jewish woman who's living with a non-Jewish man, and the Jewish woman gives birth to a baby, so the girl only has a mother, Alpidin, she has no father. Jokingly, people call that immaculate conception. The Catholics say that that's not what they mean. They say immaculate conception means something else. It doesn't even mean what we think it means. It means something else.
What would Moshe Feinstein say if the father who doesn't have the child, he's married to the woman gets a sperm donor, and the father's a Kohen, that husband's a Kohen, and the sperm donor isn't, or vice versa?
Right.
Is that baby a Kohen?
No. Okay, baby can't be a Kohen just because the husband of the woman is a Kohen.
So if the donor was a Kohen, and he says it's not a mamzer, is that kid a Kohen?
The child will be a Kohen. But others say the child is not related to the donor at all because they didn't have normal relations. And according to Abshlomo Zalman Auerbach, that's a generally accepted view. The child will be related to the donor, to the sperm donor.
I'm trying to understand why you would say the rationale is you have a husband and wife, artificial insemination. You just said now, if it's a son, it would be a Kohen if the father was. Before you said it was a question as to whether...
Right, I said it's a big question, and the accepted...
Why is it a big question? If you know he's the biological and genetic father...
Right.
Right.
Because some Rishonim say that the child is only related to the father if there was marital relations. between the husband and the wife. If it was done through artificial insemination, even though he is the husband,
I'm going to say, so he's
not psukim. He's not a psukim in Rabbi, in Yecheskel. So I mentioned that if a non-Jewish man lives with a Jewish woman, they have a girl, so the girl is not permitted to marry a kohen. That's what it says in the Gemara. That's the accepted, different opinions, that's the accepted opinion. She's not allowed to marry a kohen. So the question is, what if a woman, a Jewish woman, has artificial insemination, and the donor is a non-Jew? So the father is a non-Jew. So Moshe says there's no problem because the woman didn't violate any aveira. She wasn't living with the non-Jew, she was artificially inseminated. So others question this, because the Ravid in his commentary on the Rif on Yavamis writes that the reason why a kohen is not permitted to marry such a girl, because the girl is not a miuchesis. Vos heis the miuchesis, every kohen has to marry a girl with a big ichis, a descendant from the Baal Shem Tov, or a descendant from the Olma Goyim. What do you mean miuches? No, miuchesis means the girl has a father and a mother. So what, if a girl is a yisayma, a girl is an orphan, so a kohen can't marry? No, she has a father and a mother. The parent died, but al pidin she has a father and a mother. But if you have a girl converted, she doesn't have any father, she doesn't have any mother, al-pidin, she's not related to anybody. Or, if the father is not Jewish and the mother is Jewish, and the daughter is Jewish, so the al-pidin, the daughter only has a mother, she doesn't have a father, she was never related to the father. You can't have any relationship, you can't have any kurva between a Jew and a non-Jew. So this daughter doesn't have any father. So the same is true over here. If the donor, in this situation of the artificial insemination, if the donor is a non-Jew, and the daughter is born from the Jewish mother, so the daughter has a mother, she doesn't have a father. So there are those who don't accept Rav Moshe Feinstein's opinion. They think whenever the donor is a non-Jew, then and it's a girl, so she shouldn't marry a kohen. So that's questionable. Would you have to tell a girl she shouldn't marry a kohen or not? But this is certainly the din. If a person adopts a child, I'm a kohen and I adopt a child, so the child doesn't become a kohen automatically. The child doesn't become a lady, or I adopt a non-Jewish child. The child doesn't become Jewish all of a sudden just because I adopted him. There is a very strange discussion in the Tshuvas of the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi lived in the 1600s. He lived in Vilna at the same time as the Shach, and they had to run away for their lives when the Chmelnytsky riots were taking place. So the Chacham Tzvi ran all the way to Amsterdam. And the Shach ran to another village in Lithuania. And he lived out the rest of his life over there. And many people were killed by the Chmelnytsky pogroms. So the Chacham Tzvi writes a very strange essay. The Talmud speaks about the possibility of people creating a goylem. If you know how to mix chemicals together, so you can make all kinds of things. So the Talmud says that there were rabbis who studied Sefer Yetzirah, whatever that's all about. Sefer Yetzirah somehow tells you how God created the world, which chemicals he mixed together in order to create people. So if you mix together the right chemicals, he can create a goylem, he can create a person. There's such a story about the Maharal Miprag, probably a Baba Meisa, that someone in the 1900s invented. They have no source before the 1900s that the Maharal Miprag invented a goylem. And he used to do all the dirty work whenever there was a problem, so the Maharal would always send the goylem to take care. That's probably a Baba Meisa. But the Talmud says that there were rabbis who had the ability to use Sefer Yetzirah and to make people. So the Chacham Tzvi raises a funny shaila. If you only have 9 people in shul, you need a 10th man for the minyan. Can you use the goylem for the 10th man? Is he Jewish or not? Why should he be Jewish? He didn't have a Jewish mother. We assume the way you become Jewish, you're born to a Jewish mother. So he says no, but the Talmud has a statement that if you koham megadol yosem esof beisof, if you raise a child, hamalamed ben chaver Torah, if you teach Torah to someone else's child, malala kasu kili yalod, it's considered as if you gave birth to the child. No, I'm Jewish, so if I gave birth to a child, it would be a Jewish child. What do you mean? If I adopt a non-Jewish child, he becomes Jewish automatically? Everybody knows that. Even the non-scholars know that. A Jewish family adopts a non-Jewish child, he doesn't become Jewish automatically. So that's why it's a very strange suffix that the Chacham Tzvi raises. The Pashta certainly is. Even if you make a goylem, he's not going to be Jewish. The Chazon Ish says that the whole Chacham Tzvi doesn't make any sense at all. He says if you create a goylem, he's not a human being. He said in order to be Jewish, you have to first be a human being. So the Chazon Ish quotes the Talmud, says that Rava, Bora Gavra, Rava had the ability to create a goylem, And he created, using Sefer Yetzirah, he made a golem, and then the golem didn't have the ability to carry on a conversation. He couldn't talk. That's how they say in the Bava Mises, they say that the golem of the Ma'almi Prague also couldn't talk. So Rava was upset, of what use is this golem? He doesn't know how to talk. So he killed him, and he buried him. He killed him. How can you kill a human being? Forget about whether he's Jewish or not Jewish. How can you kill a human being? So you see, even the Gemara is not a human being. You only consider a human being if you're born from a mother. You have to have a normal birth. If you make a person with Sefer Yetzirah, not even a human being. Forget about whether he's Jewish or not. So of course there's nothing to discuss. That passage in the Talmud that the Chacham Tzvi quoted, the one who raises someone else's child, one who raises a Yosem, Malal al-Kosim Kili Yilod, is considered as if you had given birth. With respect to what is it considered as if you had given birth? So the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch say, this is with respect to the mitzvah of Piriya Verivya. We have a mitzvah every person who's able to. Some people are not able to. Every person is able to. Is supposed to get married and have children, have a son and a daughter. So what if a person is unable to have children? Physically unable. He married a woman. The woman is unable to have children. So in the days of the Talmud, they would get divorced and he would marry someone else. And Shulchan Aruch says, we don't have that practice anymore. If a person finds out that his wife is unable to have children, we wouldn't recommend that he should get divorced and try with someone else. So the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch all recommend that such a person should adopt, because by adopting children, it's considered a partial fulfillment of the mitzvah pirei v'rivya, because kol ha'megadol yosem misoch beisem al ha'kasem, it's considered ki'ilu yilod, as if he had given birth. That is a partial fulfillment of the mitzvah pirei v'rivya. It's if a person is able to have his own children, so he should not adopt. He should try to have his own children. Quite a few years ago, I remember I published an essay about birth control in the RJJ journal. So one of the passages that I quoted was this one: the one who adopts, I quoted from the Chofetz Chaim, from other Gedolim, the one who adopts, one is unable to have children, adopts a child, a Jewish child. So it's considered the partial fulfillment of the mitzvah period. So some crackpot sent in a letter to the editor, which they printed. This is terrible. Rabbi Shechter says he can partially fulfill a mitzvah period by adopting children. People are going to stop having children, they're going to start adopting. I haven't heard any normal person who's going to stop having children. People have children not because of the mitzvah period. They want to have children. It has nothing to do with the mitzvah period. I haven't heard of anybody who's going to replace their own natural children with adopting children. But that's assumed that if one is unable to have children, he should adopt. Or if it's not comfortable to adopt, so the Pasuk says in Yeshaya, he should support yeshivas. Kar ma Hashem lasarisim, Hashayish meru ha-shapsasai, v'acharu ba-shachafatzti, or machazikim bivrisi. So the Chofetz Chaim says, machazikim bivrisi means they support yeshiva education. So one who is unable to have children, a single person who didn't find a shidduch, should support a yeshiva. So he's malamid ben chaver Torah. He's supporting other people's children that they should learn Torah. So that's a partial fulfillment of Pirei V'Rivya on his part.
This concept of adoption as if you're having your own child, take that back to the idea of saying kaddish for someone who does. The Zohar is the source, and it seems as if that has some kind of merit to the parent. You think the parent who fulfills such a mitzvah, who has a child, that child saying kaddish, even if not biologically, is going to have the same merit, no?
Partially, okay. Partially.
Just the whole principle of the kolom. I understand halakha is taken from that, and I'll accept it, but it's disturbing. I mean, on something that I don't believe using the Sefer Yetzirah, they can create anything at the time. So.
But that the Talmud says. But maybe we should reinterpret the Talmud. But the Talmud does say like that. The Rava had the ability using Sefer Yetzirah to create a person. And then he was unhappy that he couldn't carry on a conversation, so he killed him and he buried him. He got rid of him. Maybe it's only an allusion to something else. But the simple reading of the Talmud that it did exist. The one who wrote all these stories died 70 years ago, 65 years ago. He made up all the Bava Mises about the garden. That was all in that thing.
Is there such a thing as a
halakhic The halacha doesn't recognize adoption, but the halacha does say if you want to adopt a non-Jewish child, you want to make him Jewish, so then you have to convert him. So that's a question. When a non-Jew comes to convert, he has to express his interest in converting. Here, the little baby is—he was just born. He's not even 8 days old yet. So what do you mean that we're converting him? He didn't express an interest to convert. So the Talmud says that converting a little baby is based on the principle of Zochen Liyadam Shalad B'Fon. We assume that it's in the best interest of the child to be brought up as a Jew as opposed to being brought up as a non-Jew. The non-Jews only have 7 mitzvahs, and we have so many more mitzvahs, and the life is so much richer, and so on. Talmud says if you take an adult who's already a non-Jew, who's used to a loose style of living, he can hang out with any women that he wants, they can eat anything that he wants, he's not restricted with the Shabbos and Yontif. So it's not in his best interest for an adult non-Jew to convert to become a Jew. If he says he wants to convert, okay, we'll negotiate, we'll accept him. But if you're dealing with a young child who didn't yet adayin by tom time of the Yisurah, he didn't get used to the style of living that he's free to do whatever he pleases. He doesn't have to observe Shabbos, doesn't have to observe Kashrus, doesn't have to observe Taras HaMishpacha. So for a young little child, we assume that it's in the best interest of the child that he should be Jewish as opposed to non-Jewish. This, of course, the commentaries on the Gemara say, this, of course, means if he's adopted by a religious couple. Don't be adopted by non-observant parents. So it's better to remain a non-Jew. It's easier to observe 7 mitzvahs b'nei noach, but you're going to adopt a non-Jewish child. You're not going to give him a Jewish education. He's going to be violating Shabbos and all the mitzvahs. He's not going to adopt, not going to wear tefillin. He's going to go to Gehenna. He'll be b'shogeg. But it's better to be a non-Jew than to be a Jew who doesn't keep any mitzvahs. What kind of a schus is that? So that's why the overwhelming majority of the poskim were of the opinion. Raditz Kochanan was of the opinion like that. And most of the rabbanim felt like that, that you can only adopt and convert the non-Jewish baby if the parents who are adopting the child are observing themselves. If they themselves are not religious, so what kind of a schus is that for the child? There was a rabbi in Frankfurt who disagreed. And there's a tshuva sefer called Sri Deyesh, where he writes that it was a chutzpah on the part of the rabbi in Frankfurt to disagree with Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan, because the overwhelming majority of the rabbanim felt like that. That's what Rav Soloveitchik also said. If you're going to adopt a non-Jewish child, you're not even going to give him a Jewish education. You don't have to send him to the most religious yeshiva, but you have to send him to give him a day school education. You're not going to give him a day school education, so the whole geiris is null and void, because you didn't give him it's not a schus. It's only considered a schus if you're going to give him a proper education.
But the Sri
Deyesh
had
a different opinion? No, the Sri Deyesh says the same, and he's upset why there was a rabbi in Frankfurt who disagreed. He said he had a chutzpah to disagree with the overwhelming majority of the rabbanim in his generation. The din is, whenever you do an act of Zochen Liyadam Shaloi B'Fonov, the Mishnah in the end of the first parak in Gittin has a situation. Let's say a man writes a get to give to his wife, and the wife is not here, the wife is out of town. So the man says, okay, I want to give you the get, you should pick up the get on behalf of my wife. Zochen Liyadam Shaloi B'Fonov. Is it a schus for the woman to get divorced from her husband? So the Mishnah assumes it's probably not a schus. Sometimes it is a schus. Sometimes the woman has been fighting for the last 20 years. She wants to get the ready from her husband, and she's battling, and then finally the husband gives in, and the wife is not around. So, okay, if you've got such a situation, it will be a schus. So if the wife is not around when the husband finally writes the get, so give the get to someone else, and they'll pick it up on behalf of the wife. But under normal circumstances, even if the Shalom Bais is not so gewaldic, we assume that it's not a schus for a woman to get divorced from her husband. Most of the women would probably want to remain with their husbands. But what if a Jewish person has an Eved Kenayni? There used to be an institution of slavery. Lincoln freed the slaves. And we don't have any more slaves in America. There are still countries in this wild world where they still have slaves. So years ago, all the countries had slaves. So if a Jewish person has an Eved Kenayni and he wants to free the Eved Kenayni, so that the Mishnah says that is a schus. It's a schus for the Eved to go free and to become a full-fledged Ben Yisrael, to be observing all the mitzvahs, and Eved Kenayni only keeps some of the mitzvahs, and not all. So it's certainly a schus to be a free man, to have freedom, and to be obligated to observe all of the mitzvahs. So the commentaries on that Gemara, the commentaries on the Mishnah pose a question. The din is, What's an example? Another example of Zachem Liyadim?
When you said that if a man wants to give his wife a gift, the woman isn't around. So, doesn't she have to appoint the Shaliach?
Normally,
she just appointed for her, and she has nothing to do with it.
If we would know that it's in her absolute best interest, so then she doesn't have to appoint the Shaliach. We can volunteer on our own the service of Shaliach Zachem Liyadim Shlavifan. But we don't assume that it's in her best interest. She probably does not want to get. So she can only become Megureshes if she appoints the Shliach. Let's say I want to give you a gift of $100,000. I have to, if there's such a bill, $100,000 bill. Let's make believe. I don't know. Jeff, okay. So I want to give you the gift. You're in Eretz Yisrael, you're not here. So I give the bill or the check to someone else. I say, you pick it up and tell it to the other person. Once he picks it up for you, we say, that's in your best interest. Now I can no longer back out. If you're not here, I say, okay, I'll put it away in my pocket. When you come back, I'll give it. I can always change my mind. Once I give it to someone else and he picks it up, he's saying it for you. Then when you find out that he did this taiva, you can always say, you don't want my taivas, goodbye. If your instinctive reaction, your initial reaction when you find out that they did a taiva on your behalf is that you don't want it, so then you cancel the whole zohar. So the commentaries ask on this Mishnah, the husband writes a get. Either he's a Meshugana or he's a normal guy. Husband writes a get and he says he wants to divorce his wife. So let someone else pick up. The wife is not here to consult her whether she wants to get or not. Let someone else pick up the get. Now the wife has all the options. If she wants to get, so she says, I wanted it. It was a source. If she doesn't want it, so she doesn't want it. So she'll cancel the whole thing. So why does the Mishnah say that the husband cannot give the get to someone else because it's not in her best interest? The violet is in her best interest. She's not going to, she stands to gain everything and to lose nothing. Now the wife has all the options. If she says she wants it, it'll be a source. If she says she doesn't want it, so it won't be a get. So you see from the Mishnah that this din of Zachem Liyadim Shleid Lefanav only applies. We can do a taiva for someone even though we didn't consult him. We assume that he probably wants it. It only applies if from the perspective of the present it looks like it is a source. I have a $100,000 bill, and you probably would like to have a gift of $100,000. So it looks like you would want it, so he can pick up the gift on your behalf, and I can't back out. Now the din says, you have the option of breaking it up. But when I want to divorce my wife right now, from the perspective of the present, it's probably not a schus. The fact that later on it may turn out with Teivosa, she may really want to get, and she may say later on, thank you very much, that's what he always wanted, but we didn't know anything about that. So from our perspective right now, it doesn't look like it's a schus. The din says, it only applies Zachem Liyadim Shleid Lefanav if it looks like it's a taiva for the other party. And later on when we tell the other person about it, the person says, yes, I want it. But if from the perspective of the present doesn't look like it's a taiva, then it's no good. Take for example, let's say you have a non-religious couple adopts a non-Jewish child and they convert the child. And it doesn't look like the child will ever be brought up with a Jewish education. The child will never know about the mitzvahs of the church. Parents don't keep Shabbos, they don't keep kashrus, they don't keep any mitzvahs. So it looks like the whole conversion is meaningless. Then the child thinks that he's Jewish, and he goes to a Jewish day school, and he goes to NCSY, and he gets all fired up about religion, he's all excited, now he wants to keep all the mitzvahs. But at the time that we did the Geirus, at the time we converted the Shabbos, it didn't look like it was going to turn out the Teivosa. Even though later on it does turn out the Teivosa, so the Pashtus is in such a case, we had no right to do the conversion in the first place. So if the person will want to, if that child will later on want to be Jewish, we won't have to repeat the Bris Milah. The Bris Milah is there. You don't have to repeat that, but they'll have to go to the mikveh again to be tevil the person again later on when they decide they do want to be Jewish, they do want to be observant. Every so often you have situations. You have two men who are living together, and they want to fulfill the mitzvah peribaribia. So they'll adopt. So they'll adopt a non-Jewish boy and a non-Jewish girl, and by adopting they're partially in fulfillment of the mitzvah peribaribia. So the question is, do we have the right to convert a child, a non-Jewish child who's going to be adopted by two men? Is that really in the best interest of the child? So we haven't had enough cases to determine whether the child is going to really turn out to be normal or not. Some psychologists guess that a child brought up by two men, or a child brought up by two women who are living together, is probably going to be tzedeit. Could be, there's a certain percentage of children in the world who are tzedeit. They're brought up by normal parents and they're tzedeit. But, okay, what can you do? A certain percentage. But the question is, are we really doing a favor to this child by having the couple, the two males, adopt him and raise him as an Orthodox Jew? The two men come to shul every Shabbos, every day. Are we doing a favor to the child? Would it have been better? He should have been brought up by non-Jewish parents. Let him be a non-Jew. Is this really a favor? So this remains to be determined. It's highly questionable whether we're doing the child a favor. And if we're not sure that, if at the present, we're not sure whether we're doing him a favor, then you can't declare Zachen Adam Shlai Befanov. It's only if it looks, from the perspective of the present, looks like we are doing him a favor. And later on when he grows up, he said he doesn't want it. Before Bar Mitzvah, he said he doesn't want it. Okay, so he can cancel the whole Gevurah. But if it, from the perspective of the present, we're not really sure whether we're doing the child a taiva or not, so then the whole conversion is not valid. There's a big hullabaloo now in Eretz Yisrael about there are girls who are older and they didn't find a shidduch, so they want to become pregnant, they want to be mothers. It's a very serious problem. It's a serious problem. Every woman has a desire to be a mother. We understand that. But most of the Rabbanim feel that this is utterly ridiculous. A girl wants to have artificial insemination because she wants to have a child, but she's crippling the child. Fine, she's going to have the feeling that she's a mother. Sometimes, unfortunately, you have a yosem. You have a child, he has a mother, he doesn't have a father. Had a mother and a father, the father died. So it's never chadit rachmanis, the child doesn't have a father. But to bring a child into the world, and when you adopt children, is also a bit rachmanis. Usually by adopted children, there's usually going to be some problem or another. It's unusual that they know that there are problems by normal children also. But there are more problems by adopted children, and there are more problems by artificial insemination children. So is that right? That because the girl has a desire to be a normal mother, so she's going to bring into the world a child who will never have a father, is going to be artificially inseminated. So most of the rabbanim say that it's highly improper. She should find a shidduch and settle on, right? They're so picky. They should have got married when they were 25 years old. Who told them to wait till they're 45 years old?
So there's enough of a data trail to make the judgment that there's no something beyond them for by artificial insemination. You said with two gays, we don't know enough yet. But with the artificial insemination, they do know. I mean,
also not right. Also not right. No, we know that a child who doesn't have a father, a yosem, is right away 10 strikes against him. But that's at least a yosem who had a father and a mother, and one of them died, or both of them died. He creating a yosem who never doesn't relate to any father. And the kid for the rest of his life is going to know that he never had a father, he never had a normal father. So for sure there's going to be a problem. For sure there's going to be a psychological problem. So we're not really doing, you don't need a schus over here. This is not based on Zachen Yadim Shlel Lefanov. If the woman becomes artificially inseminated, she's going to have a child. There won't be any conversion. But still, it's not right to bring a child into the world. There's going to be tzedreit. Is there enough? We have enough tzedreit to people. We don't have to create additional problems. One of the Hungarian poskim writes in his sefer that the expression in the Talmud when you convert a non-Jewish baby is Ger Katan Madbilim Oso Al Das Bezin. The Bezdin pushes him into the mikveh. The literal translation, Madil. So most of the Rabbanim say, that's not what it means. It doesn't mean the rabbis have to push him into the mikveh. Whoever the adoptive father, or the mother, someone should push him into the mikveh. So one of the Hungarian Gedolim from 75 years ago writes, no, that the Bezdin should push him into the mikveh. So some Rabbanim are makbid on that. Some Rabbanim are going to say, every so often I participate in a conversion for a Ger Katan. So sometimes one of the rabbanim from the Bezdin will put on his swimming trunks and he'll take the baby in his hand and he'll dip the baby in the mikveh. It's more exciting, but it's more colorful, but strictly speaking, most assume that the terminology that the Talmud uses, matbilim, is not to be taken literally. It doesn't mean that Bezdin pushes him into the mikveh. It should be done under the auspices of the Bezdin. Unfortunately, you have a lot of couples who are getting divorced, so there's always an issue of custody, who has custody of the children. So the Talmud has the following guidelines, that the children up until the age of 6 should be by the mother, And after the age of 6, if it's a boy, he should be by the father, and if it's a girl, it should be by the mother. What in the world is this based on? Kabbalah. Mysticism. What is it based on? So this is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. So the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch say, no. The main rule is that whatever is in the best interest of the child, that's how you determine who has custody. And the days of the Talmud, the rabbis felt that up until the age of 6, the children all need the mother. And after the age of 6, it makes more sense that the son should go to the father and the daughter should go to the mother. If you can ascertain in any specific case that it's just not so, so then whatever is in the best interest of the child, that's what you have to do. So today, the courts have court-appointed psychologists who spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours determining which side is mom meshugah and both meshugah. After, when a couple gets divorced, they have to determine who's more meshugah than the other, and how the custody should be, and how the visitation rights should be. And they're determined. That's what the halacha is based on, whatever is in the best interest of the child. Now they assume, and I assume, they always assume like that it's always in the best interest of the child to have a contact, to have a connection with both. A child needs a father and a mother. Even though the father and the mother are not talking to each other, they don't get along. But the child needs both a father and a mother, so it's not right that either the father or the mother should try to prevent the child from having a relationship with the other one. To what extent is a father obligated to support his children? So the Talmud has a strange statement. Up until the age of 6, the father is obligated to support the children. After 6, he can go work on his own. That's not exactly the way things run in our society, even after Bar Mitzvah in Europe. They would all learn a cheder till Bar Mitzvah. After Bar Mitzvah, they would all get a job. And then one child from every city would go to learn in the big yeshiva. I remember Rabbi Gerelick in the yeshiva said he learned in the Mir Yeshiva. Mir Yeshiva at its peak had 400 students. There isn't simply room for 400 students. If you visit the building, there isn't room for it. There were 300 plus, 350 students or so. He said, but the 400 students came from 400 different cities. There was one student who came from every city. All the others, after Bar Mitzvah, they went to work. They had to make a living. So, in Shulchan Aruch, we assume, Ramesh Feinstein has a truth about this, Shulchan Aruch, we assume that when a couple is married, the husband is mechuyev to support his wife, to give mezainis to the wife. Chumash, she'aksis v'enosa lo yigra. And the Talmud says included in the obligation to support one's wife is not only to give her enough money to buy food for herself, for all the members of the family, anim will come knocking on the door also. So the wife will probably want to give a few pennies to the anim. So included in the mezainis that you have to supply your wife with is another couple of dollars for the anim. So Moshe Feinstein writes that today the common practice is that you support your children till after they graduate college, or till after they get smicha, or till after they get married, till they get married. So that's all. And the mother would probably take the food from her mouth and give it to the children. Mothers love their children. So included in the husband's obligation to support his married wife, if they're still married together, is that he has to give the wife enough money to buy food for herself and for whoever else she would certainly want to give food to. So the aniyim, you need $5 to give to the aniyim, but you need money to give to her children. She doesn't want her children to go to work at the age of 6. She doesn't want them to go to work at the age of 13. She wants them to go through college and smicha and whatever until they get married. So Moshe Feinstein writes that today, by many, that's accepted, that until they get married, until a certain age, they get married at 45, so they're probably not going to be living by the parents. But until a certain age, still 25, whatever, they still live by the parents. So that's part of the obligation to support one's wife, is to support the children as well. There is no direct obligation to support your children after they're already 6 years old. It's through the obligation to the wife. The husband is mechuyev to give mezainis to the wife, so included in the mezainis to the wife is to support the children. What happens if the couple got divorced? So the husband is no longer obligated to support his wife. So is there any obligation to support the children? The children are 15 years old already. So according to the Talmud, the father is only obligated to support children till the age of 6. What's over here? So Moshe Feinstein says, no, that's a din like Adam Hamazik. I brought these children into the world, and I put them into a predicament. I brought them into the world, and now I divorced my wife, and now they're all left alone. So I was the one who put them in the predicament, so I have an obligation to straighten out the mess. I have an obligation to give them mezainis, and to take care, to cover their education, and so on. Whatever is normal. Whatever is considered normal. Today, if you live in America, you don't have to have such complicated cheshbonis like Moshe Feinstein wrote in his sefer. Today, the government, the American government, has laws about how much child support the husband is obligated to give after he divorces his wife. And this is a takana l'tikun ha'olam, that after a couple gets divorced, the husband, the father of the children, still has to support the children. So even though usually we assume that dina de malchusa, dina, the secular law of the land, doesn't apply, whenever there's a case involving two Jewish people, we follow the Shulchan Aruch. The dina de malchusa only applies. Dina malchusa is one thing, you have to pay taxes. That's one thing. That's between me and the government, I have to pay taxes. But dina de malchusa, with respect to a sichzach between two people, so if one of the parties is a non-Jew, then dina de malchusa sets in. If both of the parties are Jewish, then we follow Shulchan Aruch. We don't follow dina de malchusa. Unless it's a situation where the government made a takon l'tikun ha'olam. Let's say years ago, 80 years ago, there used to be Jewish landlords in New York City, and they would dafke want Jewish tenants, because if the landlord is Jewish and the tenants are Jewish, so the din of machusa doesn't apply, so you don't have to observe the laws of rent control. Or there used to be the government has laws of minimum wages. So a Jewish shop owner would hire Jews, and he doesn't have to pay minimum wages because Dina Machusa doesn't apply because all the parties involved are Jewish. So at that time, Rabbi Henkin was the big rabbi in America. Rabbi Shir wasn't yet on the scene. 80, 90 years ago, whenever it was, so Rabbi Henkin published an essay, that's a mistake. He said, whenever the government makes a takana l'tikun ha'olam, that people shouldn't skin each other alive. Rent control, the minimum wages, and so on, anything like that, is... The government didn't say that this is the din. The government made a takana. So the takana is binding even if all the parties involved are Jewish. So the same over here. The government made a takana that if a couple gets divorced, the husband still has to give, if he can afford it, has to give a certain percentage up until a certain percentage of his income to support the children. So that's a takana l'tikunam. So that's obligatory even though all the parties involved are Jewish, even though the husband, the wife, and the children are all Jewish. That's even machlokes will apply.
Rebbe mentioned before, as far as the wife being able to say to her husband, I love my children, so if it's part of my mezonos, I want you to support our children. So what if, after the couple is married, children are married, and the wife still says to the husband, it's part of my ksuba, your obligation to give me mezonos, I still want you to support our children for the next 18 years?
Yeah. It's only what's absolutely understood. Like a few dollars for the aniyim, or to give the children support till they get married, or till they reach a certain age. There's a certain age, so there are people who do it, but that's not self-understood that everybody does that. So that's not included in the mezonos of the wife. If you have a woman who, you have a couple who was married, and then they got divorced, and everybody remarried, and then everybody dies, so there's a whole discussion, this has been argument, there's no dinim about this, where do you bury them? You bury the wife next to the first husband or next to the second husband. So, strictly speaking, there are no halachas about that, so you can do whatever you please. It doesn't make a difference. The minig usually is that if a couple was married for many years and they had children together, children, grandchildren, everything, and then someone died and then they remarried, and the second marriage, they were 65 years old in the second marriage, they never had any children from the second marriage. So usually you bury together the husband next to the wife that they had the children together. Not next to the one that they didn't have children with. What if they didn't have children from either marriage, or they had children from both marriages? So then, kol ha'kaidim zocher. What? It's all menhagim. So you do whatever you want. And there are no halachas about this. Unfortunately, every so often you have a situation where you have parents who are unfit to be parents. They're abusing their children. They're abusing them in different ways. So we have no choice. So we have to try to convince the parents that you give up the children for adoption, or you give it to someone else to raise the children, take them into a home, Ohel home for children. And if the parents don't listen, you have to call the government agencies. You have no choice. You have to save the children. It says in Shulchan Aruch that if one person is harming someone else, either physically or psychologically, they're crippling someone else. So there's no prohibition of mesira. You have no choice. You have to call the police or call the government agencies and see to it that they take the children away. A lot of times when a marriage doesn't work out, so the Talmud has certain cases where the Beis Din will force the husband to give a get, even if he doesn't want to. They'll beat him up, they'll bludgeon him to death, and she'll either become an almana, or he'll agree to give the get, she'll become a grusha, which give him the choice. In America, it's hard to do that. There's a separation of church and state, so we can't say we want to beat him up because he didn't give his wife a get. The American government doesn't recognize the need for a get. They're not gonna let us enforce that. So we tried to cajole him. We tried to convince him that he should give a get in other ways. So this Sunday, they're scheduling a rally for a man who doesn't want to. He's already civilly divorced from his wife. He went to court, and the judge decided on the custody and on the visitation. Everything was decided. The husband is not happy with the decision of the court. Look, sorry, brother. Who told you to go to second court? First, they went to a Besdin. They're both religious, the husband and wife, they're both religious. First they went to Bezin, the husband saw that he's losing in the Bezin, so he went to secular court. Then he went to secular court, he lost in secular court. So now he's unhappy. So he doesn't want to give his wife a gift. So I said, how long are you not going to give the gift? Till the daughter gets married. The daughter is 3 years old. He's going to wait till the daughter gets married. Never going to be happy. I'm a sugar nut. So they're having a demonstration in front of his home. So they called up the landlord. The boys in the yeshiva called up the landlord of the home, and they said, there's going to be a demonstration on Sunday, but it's only going to be for an hour or two, whatever, and we're not going to destroy your building. So the landlord was so upset, he says he's going to kick the guy out. And the fellow works for a congressman, so the students called up the congressman, and the congressman said, he's such an immoral person, he doesn't want to give his wife a gift, that's terrible, they may fire him. They can't fire him because he's not giving his wife a gift, that's separation of church and state. But they may fire him because he's not an ethical person, he's not a moral person, there's no reason in the world why he shouldn't give his wife a gift. So we gave him the option. The boys in the yeshiva told him, you may get thrown out of your apartment, your landlord is upset, you may lose your job. So they told him, you have a whole week to give your wife a gift. You don't give the gift, we're going to have a whole demonstration on Sunday. So every so often, unfortunately, we have to have these demonstrations to encourage the husband to give his wife a gift. If it would be the reverse case, strictly speaking, a man, biblically, is permitted to have more than one wife. It's only a cherem, the Rabbeinu Gershom, that a man is not permitted to marry a second wife. So when the Rabbeinu Gershom made the prohibition against having more than one wife, so he said, if you have an unusual case where 100 rabbis will determine that this should be an exception to the rule, so then no cherem in such a case. So that's called a heter mei rabban. So usually what you do is you can't have 100 rabbis look into the case. What you have is three prominent rabbis will meet with the husband, meet with the wife, meet with if the woman is institutionalized in an insane asylum or she's sick in a hospital or whatever, so the three rabbis will study the case, and if they're convinced that the husband really deserves to have the right to marry someone else, so they'll write up the whole story in Hebrew and English, whatever, then they'll send it out in the mail to a few hundred rabbis, please read the whole story and think whether you want to agree with us or not. So you have to have 100 rabbis. So you have three, you need another 97 rabbis. And the way it was set up originally is that you have to have the head of the rabban, and has to be from Gimel Medinas, from three different countries. So the Rishonim already write that three different countries doesn't have to be Dafka, France and Spain and Germany. There are different sections in Spain. So Aragon and whatever, they write the different areas in Spain, people have different ways of thinking. The people in Borough Park think one way. The people in New Jersey think differently. The people in Connecticut think differently. So if you have three different states, that's also assumed to be Gimel Medinas. Well, let's say, usually when you have a Heter Mei Rabbanan, so someone will go, a few times I happened to go to Eretz Yisrael to a rabbinical conference, I would bring a Heter Mei Rabbanan with me. So many Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael would sign on. Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, people who live in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbanim have a totally different perspective of the world. I would meet rabbis from South Africa there at the rabbinical conference in America, in Eretz Yisrael. So they would take it back. They would take back the Heter Mei Rabbanan to South Africa. They would study it. And if they thought to sign along, so we had mamish people from three different medinas, from South Africa, from America, and from Eretz Yisrael. That's if the wife is unable to receive a get, she's institutionalized, or the wife refuses to accept a get. So you have to ascertain, is she really doing something improper? Maybe the husband is doing the wrong thing. The husband is not always right. Sometimes the husband has no right to divorce his wife, to divorce his wife. Whenever you make a heter mei rabbanim to permit the husband to remarry, so the practice always is the husband writes a get and he gives it to the bezdin, and they know that the bezdin notifies the woman, we have a get waiting for you. As soon as you're ready, please come and pick it up and we'll give you the get. And in the meanwhile, after the get was given, and he has to put money in escrow, the amount of money that he has to give his wife for the ksuba. Whenever a husband divorces his wife, he has to pay a ksuba. So he has to write the get and leave it by the bezin, put the money in escrow in a bank account, so that when the woman will finally decide that she wants to accept the get, so she'll have the get, she'll have the money. And then in the meanwhile, we permit the husband to remarry. But if it's the reverse case, that the wife wants to remarry, so then Hetamei Rabbanim is not going to work. Hetamei Rabbanim is only when you're just dealing with the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, which is only with the Rabbanim. So when he made his Cherem, when he made his Iser, he made an exception to the rule, that if you have an unusual case, and 100 Rabbanim will say that we should permit the husband to remarry, that's okay. But for the wife to remarry, that's already a biblical prohibition. So that's not going to help. All the Rabbanim in the world are not going to help. Unfortunately, from time to time, I have to participate in a din Torah about gittin and about forcing the husband to give a get, encouraging the husband. It's a very aggravating thing. But look, life is life, and these are things that always happen like this, issues of custody and so on. Okay, we have to try to preserve the Jewish family as well as we can.
So I have a friend who studied in Parvadas when you were studying at the yeshiva, and they would walk the head of mayor running around the basement or should they tell him something?
Years ago, a rabbi, he was the rabbi of the whole community, and he had his own yeshiva. So the Nadi Yehuda writes, you don't need 100 rabbanim toifsi yeshiva, the rabbi of the whole community, and he has his own yeshiva and everything. If you have 100 talmid chachamim, is also good. So the later rabbanim said, when the Nadi Yehuda said that, he meant as a kula. You don't need big rabbis. 100 talmid chachamim is enough. Now it's easier to find 100 rabbis than to find 100 talmid chachamim. Where are you going to find 100 talmid chachamim? That's what everybody said. The Nadi Yehuda said it as a kula. And now it's a chumra. So we try to... That's not right. Ask all the boys in the yeshiva to sign a hetamei rabbanim. That's not. But let's say the boys who have smicha, even if they don't have a rabbinical position, but they have smicha, so that we would accept that. That's considered, on our level, that's considered 100 talmid chachamim. If a person learned till he got smicha, that's called 100 talmid chachamim.
A single girl who wants to have a child,
because the next thing you know is going to be the girl's going to have an affair with someone. That's what a lot of these girls do. And they say that they were artificially inseminated. Every girl is going to want to have an affair, so they're artificially inseminated. And secondly, you're creating a yosem. If you have Nebuchadnezzar, child who lost his father, lost his mother, so he became a yosem, it's Rahman. So you're creating a yosem, yesh meyai. So is that right that because the girl has such a desire, all women have such a desire to give birth to a natural child. They want to have their own child because she has such a desire. So that's why she should be permitted to create the child who's going to have problems. The pashtus of the child will certainly have psychological problems.
Isn't there a concept in Gemara Ksubas that the idea that it's better for a woman to be married, even not the ideal marriage that she can anymore?
Right, she should settle already. She should settle. The girls are so picky. I don't know, when I got married, we didn't discuss all the world's issues. You met a nice girl and you fell in love and you got married. Well, what was the big problem? So we'll get her a nice boy. They shouldn't be so picky.
There are single women that adopt children too.
There are? Yes. Okay. No. If you have a child that's up for adoption anyway, it's Nebuchadnezzar Rachmanis. The child is Nebuchadnezzar Yosem. So it probably would make better sense to have the child adopted by a family where there's a father and a mother. You can have a child adopted by a mother, okay? But to have artificially inseminated, for sure there's going to be a psychological problem. They all have psychological problems. Okay? Yes?
What about the situation where you have a living orphan where a child was given up by the particular parents at an early age where the parents couldn't take care of them?
later on they find out that they were, you know,
who their parents are, right?
Right. So in that situation, how do you give that kind of honor or
strictly speaking, this is my parents. I still have an obligation to show, keep it up, keep it out to the parents. To the best of your ability. Like a lot of times the father just left the mother when the baby was born, before the baby was born, and the child is angry at the parent who left. Still, but if they can't get themselves to show keep it up, so they're fucked. But if they're able to, at least they should try to fulfill it. If the child is unable to show keep it up to the parent because the parent was abusive, yeah, I know a lot of times like that. The parents are so abusive, the children run away when they're old enough to do something. They don't want to have anything to do with the parents. How can you require of the child that they should show keep it up? They have scars. They have psychological scars because of their parents.
So the same thing, they're giving up with the parents for adoption, so the same thing.
It depends. Sometimes they won't. They won't leave any psychological stuff. Parents are unable to raise them, so someone else raises them. But they can still be on good terms with their biological parents. It depends. Every case is different. To the best of their ability, they should try to fulfill. Keep it up. See ya. Very good. Okay.
I'm going to touch that one. I'm going to touch that one.